was roaring with laughter.
It's an insult.
Hierarch Hemelfart gasped for air.
It's a scandal. It's unpardonable.
Vile people, hissed Priest Villima. Pretend you can't see it, Foltest advised calmly. We shouldn't have economized on their pay, Maeve said sourly, or refused them rations. The dwarven officers kept their countenance and form, standing erect and saluting in front of the review stand, whereas the non-commissioned officers and soldiers of the volunteer regiment expressed their disapproval of the budget cuts applied by the kings and the hierarch. Some crooked their elbows as they passed the stand, while others demonstrated their other favourite gesture, a fist with a middle finger stuck stiffly upwards. In academic circles, that gesture bore the name Digitus Infamis. The plebs had a cruder name for it. The blushes on the faces of the kings and the hierarch demonstrated that they knew both names.
We ought not to have insulted them by our miserliness, Maeve repeated. They're an ambitious nation.
The howler in Elskadeg howled. The howling turned into a horrifying wailing call. None of the men sitting by the campfire turned his head around. Boreas Munn was the first to speak after a long silence.
The world has changed. Justice has been done.
Well, you might be exaggerating with that justice.
The pilgrim smiled slightly.
I would agree, though, that the world has in some way adapted itself to the basic law of physics.
I wonder if we have the same law in mind,
the elf said in a slow, drawling voice.
Every action causes a reaction, said the pilgrim.
The elf snorted, but it was quite a friendly snort.
That's a point for you, human.
Stefan Skellen, son of Bertram Skellen, you, who were Imperial Coroner, be upstanding. The High Tribunal of the Eternal Empire, by grace of the Great Sun, has found you guilty of the crimes and illegitimate acts of which you have been charged, namely, treason and participation in a conspiracy intended to bring about a murderous assault on the statutory order of the Empire and also on the person of the Imperial Majesty. Your guilt, Stefan Skellen, has been confirmed and proven, and the tribunal has not found extenuating circumstances. His Royal Imperial Majesty has thus not granted you an imperial pardon. Stefan Skellen, son of Bertram Skellen, you will be taken from the courtroom to the citadel, from where, when the apposite time comes, you will be led out. As a traitor, unworthy of treading the soil of the Empire, you will be placed on a wooden cart, and horses will pull you to Millennium Square on that cart. As a traitor, unworthy of breathing the air of the Empire, you will be hanged by the neck on a gallows, by the hand of an executioner, between heaven and earth, and you will hang until you are dead. Your corpse will be cremated, and the ashes tossed to the four winds. O Stefan Skellen, son of Bertram, traitor, I, the head of the highest tribunal of the Empire, sentencing you, utter your name for the last time. May it henceforth be forgotten.
It works! It works!
Shouted Professor Oppenhauser, rushing into the Dean's office.
It works, gentlemen! Finally! Finally! It functions! It rotates! It works! It works!
Really?
Jean Lavoisier, Professor of Chemistry, called rotten eggs by his students, asked bluntly and quite sceptically.
It can't be. And what, out of interest, works?
My perpetual motion machine.
A perpetuum mobile?
Edmund Bumbler, venerable zoology lecturer, asked curiously.
Indeed. You aren't exaggerating, my dear colleague.
Not in the slightest,
yelled Oppenhauser, and leapt like a goat.
Not a bit. It works. The machine works. I set it in motion, and it works. It runs continuously, without stopping, permanently, forever and ever. It can't be described, colleagues. You must see it. Come to my lab, quickly.
I'm having my breakfast, protested Rotten Eggs.
But his protest was lost in the hubbub and general excited commotion. Professors, magisters and bachelors threw coats and fur coats over their gowns and ran for the exit, led by Oppenhauser, still shouting and gesticulating. Rotten Eggs pointed his digitus infamous at them and returned to his roll and forcemeat. The small group of scholars, constantly being joined by more scholars, greedy to see the fruits of Oppenhauser's 30 years of labours, briskly covered the distance separating them from the laboratory of the famous physicist. They were just about to open the door when the ground suddenly shook, perceptibly, powerfully, actually, very powerfully, actually. It was a seismic wave, one of the series of earthquakes caused by the destruction of Stigger Castle, Vilgefortz's hideout, by the sorceresses. The seismic wave had come all the way to Oxenfurt from distant Ebbing. Dozens of pieces of glass exploded with a crash from the stained glass window on the frontage of the Department of Fine Arts. The bust of Nicodemus de Boot, the Academy's first rector, scrawled over with rude words, fell from its plinth. The cup of herb tea with which Rotten Eggs was washing down his roll and forcemeat fell from the table. A first-year physics student, Albert Solpietra, fell from a plantain tree in the Academy grounds that he had climbed to impress some female medical students. And Professor Oppenhauser's Perpetuum Mobile, his legendary perpetual motion engine, turned over once more and stopped. Forever. And it was never possible to start it again.
Long live the dwarves! Long live Mahakam!
What kind of mixed bunch is this? What gang of ruffians?
Thought Hierarch Hemelfart, blessing the parade with a trembling hand.
Who's being cheered here? Venal condottieri? Obscene dwarfs? What a bizarre bunch. Who won this war, after all? Them or us? By the gods, I must draw the king's attention to this. When historians and writers get down to their work, their scribblings ought to be censored. Mercenaries, witches, hired brigands, non-humans, and all other suspicious elements are to vanish from the chronicles of humanity, are to be deleted, expunged. Not a word about them, not a word. And not a word about him either,
he thought, pursing his lips and looking at Dykstra, who was observing the parade with a distinctly bored expression.
It will be necessary, thought the Hierarch, to issue the kings with instructions regarding Dykstra. His presence is an insult to decent people. He's a heathen and a scoundrel. May he disappear without trace, and may he be forgotten.
Over my dead body, you sanctimonious purple hog, thought Philippa Eilhart, effortlessly reading the Hierarch's feverish thoughts. You'd like to rule. You'd like to dictate and influence. You'd like to decide things. Over my dead body. All you can make judgments about are your piles, which don't count for much beyond your own arse. And Dykstra will remain. As long as I need him.
You'll make a mistake one day, thought Priest Willimer, looking at Philippa's shining crimson lips. One day one of you will make a mistake. Your vainglory, arrogance and hubris will be your undoing, and your scheming, your immorality, the baseness and perversion which you give yourselves unto in which you live, it will come to light. The stench of your sins will spread when you make a mistake. Such a moment has to come. And even if you don't make a mistake, an opportunity will arise to blame you for something. Some misfortune, some disaster, some pestilence, perhaps a plague or an epidemic will fall on humanity. Then your guilt will descend on you. You will not be blamed for having been unable to prevent the plague, but for being unable to remove its effects. You shall be to blame for everything. And then fires will be lit under stakes.
The stripy old tomcat, called Ginger because of its colouring, was dying. Dying hideously. He was rolling around, writhing, scratching the ground, vomiting blood and mucus, racked by convulsions. On top of that, he had bloody diarrhoea, He was meowing, although it was beneath his dignity. Meowing mournfully, softly. He was weakening fast. Ginger knew why he was dying, or at least guessed what was killing him. Several days before, a strange freighter, an old and very dirty hulk, a neglected tub, almost a wreck, had called at the port of Sintra. Katrina, announced the barely visible letters on the hulk's prow. Ginger naturally couldn't read the letters. A rat climbed down the mooring line to alight on the quay from the strange old tub. A single rat. The rat was hairless, lousy and sluggish, and only had one ear. Ginger killed the rat. He was hungry, but instinct prevented him from eating the hideous creature. However, several fleas, big, shiny fleas, teeming in the rodent's fur, managed to crawl onto Ginger and settle in his coat.
"What's up with that sodding cat?"
"Someone probably poisoned it or put a spell on it."
"Ugh, abomination. It doesn't half stink, the scoundrel. Get him off those steps, woman."
Ginger stiffened and silently opened his bloody maw. He no longer felt the kicks or pokes of the broom with which the housewife was now thanking him for 11 years of catching mice. Kicked out of the yard, he was dying in a gutter, frothing with soap suds and urine. He died, wishing that those ungrateful people would also fall ill and suffer like him. His wishes were about to come true, and on a great scale. A great scale indeed. The woman who had kicked and swept Ginger from the yard stopped, lifted her frock and scratched her calf below the knee. It was itchy. A flea had bitten her. The stars over Elskadeg twinkled intensively. They formed the backdrop against which the sparks from the campfire were dying out.
"Neither can the peace of Sintra," said the elf, "nor yet the bombastic Novigradian parade be considered a watershed or a milestone. What kind of notions are they? Political authority cannot create history with the help of acts or decrees. Neither can political authority assess history, give grades or characterize it, although in its pride no authority would ever acknowledge that truth. One of the more extreme signs of your human arrogance is so-called historiography, the attempts to give opinions and pass sentences about what you call ancient history. It's typical for you people, and results from the fact that nature gave you an ephemeral, insectile, ant-like life, and an average lifespan of less than 100 years. You, however, try to adapt the world to that insectile existence. And meanwhile, history is a process that occurs ceaselessly and never ends. It's impossible to separate history into episodes from here to there, from here to there, from date to date. You can't define history nor change it with a royal address, even if you've won a war."
"I won't enter into a philosophical dispute," said the pilgrim. "As it's been said before, I'm a simple and not very eloquent fellow, but I dare observe two things. Firstly, a lifespan as short as insects protects us, people, from decadence, and inclines us to respect life, live intensively and creatively, in order to make the most of every moment of life and enjoy it. I speak and think like a man, but after all, the long-lived elves thought likewise, going to fight and die in the Skoyatael commando units. If I'm wrong, please correct me."
The pilgrim waited a suitable length of time, but no one corrected him.
"Secondly," he continued, "it seems to me that political authority, although unable to change history, may by its actions produce quite a fair illusion and appearance of such an ability. Political power has methods and instruments to do so."
"Oh, yes," replied the elf, turning his face away. "Here you've hit the nail on the head, Master Pilgrim. Power has methods and instruments which are in no way open to discussion."
The galley's side struck the seaweed and shell-covered piles. Mooring ropes were thrown. Shouts, curses and commands resounded. Seagulls shrieked as they scavenged for the refuse floating in the port's dirty green water. The quayside was teeming with people, mainly uniformed.
"End of the voyage, gentlemen elves," said the Nilfgaardian commander of the convoy. "We're in Dillingen. Everybody off, you're being waited for here."
It was a fact. They were being waited for. None of the elves, and certainly not Foeltiana, had any faith in the assurances of fair trials or amnesties. The Scoia'tael and the officers of the Vrihedd Brigade had no illusory hopes about the fate awaiting them on the far side of the Yeruga. In the majority of cases, they had become accustomed to it, accepted it stoically, with resignation even. Nothing, they thought, could astonish them now. They were mistaken. They were chased from the galley, jingling and clanking their manacles, driven onto the jetty and then onto the quay, between a double line of armed mercenaries. There were also civilians there, whose sharp eyes flashed quickly, flitting from face to face, from figure to figure. Selectors, thought Foeltiana. He wasn't mistaken. He couldn't expect, naturally, his disfigured face to be overlooked. And he wasn't.
"Mr. Isengrim Foeltiana? The Iron Wolf? What a pleasant surprise! Come this way, come this way!"
The mercenaries dragged him out of the ranks.
"Fafil!"
Conach the Reo shouted to him. He had been recognized and hauled out by other soldiers wearing gorgets with the Redanian eagle.
"Sevid, Sekirmadia!"
"You'll be seeing each other,"
hissed the civilian who had selected Foeltiana, "but probably in hell. They're already waiting for him in Drakenborg. Hello, stop!
Isn't that by chance Mr. Reardon?
Seize him."
In all, they pulled out three of them. Just three. Foeltiana understood and suddenly, to his surprise, began to be afraid.
"Hafeel!"
Angus Bri'Cree shouted to his comrades as he was pulled out of the rank, manacles jingling.
"Hafeel, Freeran!"
A mercenary shoved him roughly. They weren't taken far. They only got to one of the sheds close to the harbour, right next to the dock, over which a forest of masts swayed. The civilian gave a sign. Foeltiana was pushed against a post under a beam over which a rope was slung. An iron hook was attached to the rope. Reardon and Angus were sat down on two stools on the dirt floor.
"Mr. Reardon, Mr. Bri'Cree," said the civilian coldly, "you have been given an amnesty. The court decided to show mercy. But justice must be done," he added, not waiting for a reaction.
"And the families of those whom you murdered have paid for it to happen, gentlemen. The verdict has been reached."
Reardon and Angus didn't even manage to cry out. Nooses were thrown over their necks. They were throttled, knocked down along with the stools and dragged across the floor. As they vainly tried with their manacled hands to tear off the nooses, biting into their necks, the executioners kneeled on their chests. Knives flashed and fell, blood spurted. Now even the nooses were unable to stifle their screams, their hair-raising shrieks. It lasted a long time, as always.
"Your sentence, Mr. Foeltiana, was equipped with an additional clause," said the civilian, turning his head slowly. "Something extra."
Foeltiana had no intention of waiting for that something extra. The manacle's clasp, which the elf had been working on for 2 days and nights, now fell from his wrist as though tapped by a magic wand. With a terrible blow of the heavy chain, he knocked down both mercenaries guarding him. Foeltiana, in full flight, kicked the next one in the face, lashed the civilian with the manacles, hurled himself straight at the cobweb-covered window of the shed and flew through it, taking the frame and casing with him, leaving blood and shreds of clothing on the nails. He landed on the planks of the jetty with a thud. He turned, tumbled forward, rolled over and dived into the water between the fishing boats and launches. The heavy chain, still attached to his right wrist, was dragging him down to the bottom. Foeltiana fought. He fought with all his strength for his life, which not so long before he hadn't thought he cared about.
"Catch him!" yelled the mercenaries, rushing from the shed. "Catch him! Kill him! Over there!" yelled others, running up along the jetty. "There! He came up there! To the bolts! Shoot!"
roared the civilian, trying with both hands to stop the blood gushing from his eye socket.
Kill him!
The strings of crossbows twanged. Seagulls flew up shrieking. The dirty green water between the launches seethed with crossbow bolts.
Vivant!
The parade stretched out, and the crowd of Novigradians were now displaying signs of fatigue and hoarseness.
Vivant! Long live the army! Hurrah! Glory to the kings! Glory!
Philippa Eilhart looked around to see that no one was listening, then leaned over towards Dykstra. What do you want to talk to me about? The spy also looked around.
About the assassination of King Vizimir, carried out last July.
I beg your pardon?
The half-elf who committed that murder,
Dykstra lowered his voice even more,
was by no means a madman, Phil, and wasn't acting alone.
What are you saying?
Hush!
Dykstra smiled.
Hush, Phil.
Don't call me Phil. Do you have any proof? What kind? Where did you get it?
You'd be surprised, Phil, if I told you where.
When can I expect an audience, honourable lady? Philippa Eilhart's eyes were like two black bottomless lakes.
Soon, Dykstra.
The bells tolled. The crowd cheered hoarsely. The army paraded. Petals covered the Novigradian cobbles like snow.
Are you still writing?
Ori Ruvin started and made a blot. He had served Dykstra for 19 years, but was still not accustomed to the noiseless movements of his boss, appearing from God knows where and God knows how.
Good evening. You're on Men from the Shadows.
Dykstra read the title page of the manuscript, which he had picked up unceremoniously from the table.
The History of the Royal Secret Services, written by Oribasius Gianfranco Paolo Reuven, Magister. Oh, Ori, Ori. An old fellow and such foolishness. I came to say goodbye, Ori.
Reuven looked at him in surprise.
You see, my loyal comrade, continued the spy, without waiting for his secretary to cough anything up, I'm also old, and it turns out I'm also foolish. I said one word to one person, just one person, and just one word. It was one word too many, and one person too many. Listen carefully, Ori. Can you hear them?
Ori Ruvin shook his head, his eyes wide open in amazement. Dykstra said nothing for a time.
You can't hear, he said after a moment. But I can hear them. In all the corridors. Rats are running through the city of Traitor-Gore. They're coming here. They're coming on soft little rats' paws.
They came out of the shadows, out of the darkness, dressed in black, masked as nimble as rats. The sentries and bodyguards from the antechambers dropped without moaning under the quick thrusts of daggers with narrow, angular blades. Blood flowed over the floors of Traitor-Gore Castle, spilled over the tiles, stained the woodblocks, soaked into the Vengerbergian carpets. They approached along all the corridors and left corpses behind them.
He's there, said one of them, pointing.
The scarf shrouding his face up to his eyes muffled his voice.
He went in there, through the chancery, where Reuven, that coffin old coot, works.
There's no way out of there.
The eyes of the other one, the commander, shone in the slits of his black velvet mask.
The chamber behind the chancery is windowless. There's no way out.
All of the other corridors are covered. All the doors and windows. He can't escape. He's trapped.
Forward.
The door gave way to kicks. Daggers flashed.
Death! Death to the bloody killer!
Him?
Ori Ruvin raised his myopic, watery eyes above the papers.
Yes? How can I help you, gentlemen?
The murderers smashed open the door to Dykstra's private chambers, scurried around them like rats, searching through all the nooks and crannies. Tapestries, paintings and panels were torn from the walls, fell onto the floor. Daggers slashed curtains and upholsteries.
He's not here!
Yelled one of them, rushing into the chancery.
He's not here!
Where is he?
rasped the gang leader, leaning over Ori, staring at him through the slits in his black mask. Where is that bloodthirsty dog?
He's not here,
Ori Reuven replied calmly.
You can see for yourself.
Where is he? Talk! Where's Dykstra?
Am I? Coughed Ori. My brother's keeper.
Die, old man.
I'm old, sick, and very weary. I fear neither you nor your knives.
The murderers ran from the chamber. They vanished as quickly as they had appeared. They didn't kill Ori Reuven. They were paid killers, and there hadn't been the slightest mention of Ori Reuven in their orders. Oribasius Gianfranco Paolo Reuven, master at law, spent 6 years in various prisons, constantly interrogated by various investigators, asked about all sorts of apparently senseless things and matters. He was released after 6 years. He was very ill by then. Scurvy had taken away all his teeth, anemia his hair, glaucoma his eyesight, and asthma his breath. The fingers of both hands had been broken during the interrogations. He lived for less than a year after being freed. He died in a temple poorhouse, in misery, forgotten. The manuscript of the book Men from the Shadows, The History of the Royal Secret Services, vanished without trace. The sky in the east brightened. A pale glow appeared above the hills, the harbinger of the dawn. Silence had reigned by the campfire for a long time. The pilgrim, the elf, and the tracker looked into the dying fire in silence. Silence reigned in Elskadeg. The howling phantom had gone away, bored by its vain howling. The phantom must have finally understood that the three men sitting by the campfire had seen too many atrocities lately to worry about any old spectre.
If we are to travel together, we must abandon mistrust, Boreas Munn said suddenly, looking into the campfire's ruby glow. Let's leave behind us what was. The world has changed. There's a new life in front of us. Something has ended. Something is beginning. Ahead of us.
He broke off and coughed. He was not accustomed to speeches like that, was afraid of looking ridiculous. But his accidental companions weren't laughing.
Why, Boreas positively sensed friendliness emanating from them. The pass of Elskadeg is ahead of us, he ended in a more confident voice. And beyond the pass, Sericania and Hackland. There's a long and dangerous road ahead of us. If we are to travel together, let's abandon mistrust. I am Boreas Munn.
The pilgrim in the wide-brimmed hat stood up, straightening his great frame, and shook the hand being held out towards him. The elf also stood up, his horrifyingly disfigured face contorted strangely. After shaking the tracker's hand, the pilgrim and the elf held out their right hands towards each other.
The world has changed, said the pilgrim. Something has ended. I am Siggy Reuven.
Something is beginning.
The elf twisted his ravaged face into something that, according to all evidence, was a smile.
I am Wolf Isengrim.
They shook hands, quickly, firmly, downright violently. For a moment, it looked more like the preliminaries to a fight than a gesture of reconciliation, but only for a moment. The log in the campfire shot out sparks, celebrating the event with a joyful firework.
God strike me down, Boreas Munn smiled broadly. If this isn't the start of a beautiful friendship.
Along with the other martyr sisters, St. Philippa was also calumniated for betraying the kingdom, for fomenting tumults and sedition, for inciting the people and plotting an insurrection. Vilmerius, a heretic and cultist and self-appointed high priest, ordered the saint to be seized, thrown into a dark and foul prison beset with cold and stench, calling on her to confess her sins and declare those that she had committed. And Vilmerius showed St. Philippa divers instruments of torture and menaced her greatly. But the saint merely spat in his countenance and accused him of sodomy. The heretic ordered her stripped of her raiment and thrashed mercilessly with leather straps and for splinters to be driven under her fingernails. And then he asked and called on her to disavow her faith and the goddess. But the saint merely laughed and advised him to distance himself. Then he ordered her dragged to the torture chamber, and her whole body to be harrowed with iron gaffs and hooks, and her sides scorched with candles. And although thus tormented, the saint in her mortal corpse showed immortal forbearance, until the torturers were enfeebled and withdrew in great horror. But Vilmerius fiercely admonished them and ordered them further to torture her and soundly belabor her. They then began to scorch St. Philippa with red-hot irons, dislocate her members from the joints, and rend the woman's breast with pincers. And in this suffering, she, having confessed nothing, expired. And the godless, shameless Vilmerius, about whom you may read in the works of the Holy Fathers, met such a punishment that lice and worms spread over him and overcame him until he was decayed all over and expired. And he reeked like a cur such that he needs must be cast into a river without burial. For which praise and a martyr's crown are due to St. Philippa, and glory forever to the great Mother Goddess, and to us a lesson and a warning. Amen. The life of St. Philippa the Martyr of Mons Calvus, copied from the Martyr Scribes in the Tertullian Breviary, summarized, drawn from many holy fathers who praise her in their writings. Chapter 11. They rushed like the wind, like mad things, at breakneck speed. They rode through the days, now burgeoning with spring. The horses carried them in a light-footed gallop, and the people, straightening their necks and backs from toiling on the soil, watched them as they went, uncertain of what they had seen, riders or apparitions. They rode through the nights, dark and wet from the warm rain, and the people, woken and sitting up on their pallets, looked around terrified, fighting the choking pain that rose in their throats and chests. People sprang up, listening to the thud of shutters, to the crying of those rested from sleep, to the howling of dogs. They pressed their faces to the parchment in their windows, uncertain of what they had seen, riders or apparitions. After ebbing, tales of the three demons began to circulate. The three riders appeared from God knows where and God knows how, completely astonishing Pegleg and giving him no chance to flee. Neither was there any help to call for. A good 500 paces separated the cripple from the outermost buildings of the small town, and even if it had been closer, there was a slender chance that any of Jealousy's inhabitants would bother about someone calling for help. It was siesta time, which in Jealousy usually lasted from late morning until early evening. Aristoteles Bobek, nicknamed Pegleg, the local beggar and philosopher, knew only too well that Jealousy residents didn't react to anything during siesta time. There were three riders, two women and a man. The man had white hair and wore a sword slung across his back. One of the women, more mature and dressed in black and white, had raven black hair curled in locks. The younger one, whose straight hair was the colour of ash, had a hideous scar on her left cheek. She was sitting on a splendid black mare. Pegleg felt he'd seen a mare like that before. It was the younger one that spoke first. "Are you from round here?"
"It wasn't me,"
Pegleg said, teeth chattering.
"I'm not but gathering mushrooms. Forgive me. Don't harm a cripple."
"Are you from round here?" she repeated, and her green eyes flashed menacingly. Pegleg cowered.
"Aye, noble lady," he mumbled. "I'm a local, right enough. I was born here in Birka, in Jealousy, and I shall no doubt die here."
"Last year, in the summer and autumn, were you here?"
"Where should I have been?"
"Answer when I ask you."
"I was, good lady."
The black mare shook its head and pricked up its ears. Pegleg felt the eyes of the other two, the black-haired woman and the white-haired man, pricking him like hedgehog spines. The white-haired man scared him the most. "A year ago," continued the girl with the scar, "in the month of September, the 9th of September to be precise, in the first quarter of the moon,
6 young people were murdered here. 4 lads and 2 girls. Do you recall?
Pegleg swallowed. For some time he had suspected, and now he knew, now he was certain. The girl had changed, and it wasn't just that scar on her face. She was completely different to how she had been when she was screaming, tied to a hitching post, watching as Bonnard cut off the heads of the murdered rats. Quite different to how she had been in the Chimera's head when Bonnard undressed and beat her. Only the eyes. The eyes hadn't changed.
Talk. The other black-haired woman urged him. You were asked a question.
I remember, my lord and ladies, confirmed Pegleg. How could I not remember? 6 youngsters were killed. By truth, it was last year, in September.
The girl said nothing for a long time, looking not at him, but somewhere in the distance over his shoulder.
So, you must know, she finally said with effort. You must know where those boys and those girls were buried. By which fence? On what rubbish tip or muck heap? Or if their bodies were cremated? If they were taken to the forest and left for the foxes and wolves? You'll show me that place. You'll take me there. Understand?
I understand, noble lady. Come with me, for it's not far at all.
He hobbled, feeling on his neck the hot breath of their horses. He didn't look back. Something told him he shouldn't.
Here it is, he finally pointed. This is our jealousy boneyard, here in this grove. And the ones you was talking about, Miss Falker, they lie over there.
The girl gasped audibly. Pegleg glanced furtively and saw her face changing. The white-haired man and the black-haired woman were silent and their faces inscrutable. The girl looked long at the small barrow. It was orderly, level, tidy, edged by blocks of sandstone and slabs of spar and slate. The fir branches that the burial mound had been decorated with had turned brown. The flowers that had once been laid there were dry and yellowed. The girl dismounted.
Who?
She asked dully, still looking, not turning her head away.
Well, many jealousy people helped.
Pegleg cleared his throat.
But chiefly the widow Gulu and young Niklar. The widow was always a good and sincere dame, and Niklar, his dreams tormented him terribly. He wouldn't give him rest until he'd given the murdered ones a decent burial.
Where shall I find them? The widow and Niklar?
Pegleg said nothing for a long time.
The widow is buried there, beyond that crooked little birch, he said at last,
looking without fear into the girl's green eyes.
She died of pneumonia in the winter of the year, and Niklar joined the army somewhere in foreign parts. Folks say he fell in the war.
I forgot, she whispered. I forgot that destiny tied both of them to me.
She approached the small burial mound and knelt down, or rather fell onto one knee. She bent over low, very low, her forehead almost touching the stones around the base. Pegleg saw the white-haired man make a movement, as though meaning to dismount, but the black-haired woman caught him by the arm, stopping him with a gesture and a look. The horses snorted, shook their heads, the rings of their bits jingling. The girl knelt for a long, long time at the foot of the burial mound, bent over, and her mouth moved in some silent litany. She staggered as she stood up. Pegleg held her up instinctively. She flinched hard, jerked her elbow away, and looked at him malevolently through her tears. But she didn't say a word. She even thanked him with a nod when he held her stirrup for her.
Yes, noble Miss Falker, he dared to say. Fate ran a strange course. You were in grievous strife then and bitter times. Few of us here in jealousy thought you'd get out of it alive. And finally,
You're healthy today, my lady. And Gulu and Nikla are in the beyond. There's not even anyone to thank, eh? To repay for the burial mound?
My name's not Falka, she said harshly. My name's Ciri. And as far as thanks are concerned, feel honoured by her.
The black-haired woman interjected coldly. And there was something in her voice that made Pegleg tremble.
Grace, gratitude and reward have befallen you, you and your entire settlement.
You know not even how great, said the black-haired woman, slowly enunciating her words.
For the burial mound, for your humanity, and for your human dignity and decency.
On the 9th of April, soon after midnight, the first residents of Clermont were awoken by a flickering brightness, a red blaze that struck and flooded into the windows of their homesteads. The rest of the town's residents were roused from their beds by screams, commotion, and the insistent sounds of the bell tolling the alarm. Only one building was burning. It was huge and wooden, formerly a temple, once consecrated to a deity whose name even the oldest grandmothers couldn't remember. A temple now converted into an amphitheatre, where animal baiting, fights and other entertainment was held, capable of hauling the small town of Clermont out of its boredom, depression and drowsy torpor. It was the amphitheatre that was now burning in a sea of roaring fire, shaking from explosions. Ragged tongues of flame, several yards long, shot from all the windows.
Fire!
Roared the merchant Huvenagel, the owner of the amphitheatre, running and waving his arms around, his great paunch wobbling. He was wearing a nightcap and a heavy caracul coat he had thrown over his nightshirt. He was kneading the dung and mud of the street with his bare feet.
Fire! Help! Water!
It's a divine punishment, pronounced one of the oldest grandmothers authoritatively, for those rumpuses they held in the house of worship.
Yes, yes, madam, no doubt about it.
A glow emanated from the roaring theatre. Horse urine steamed and stank, and sparks hissed in puddles. A wind had got up from God knows where.
Put out the fire!
Huvenagel howled desperately, seeing it spreading to the brewery and granary.
Help! Fetch buckets! Fetch buckets!
There was no shortage of volunteers. Why, Clermont even had its own fire brigade, equipped and maintained by Huvenagel. They tried to put the fire out doggedly and with dedication, but in vain.
We can't cope, groaned the chief of the fire brigade, wiping his blistered face. That's no ordinary fire. It's the devil's work. Black magic!
Another fireman choked on the smoke. From inside the amphitheatre could be heard the terrible cracking of rafters, ridges and posts breaking. There was a roar, a bang and a crash. A great column of fire and sparks exploded into the sky, and the roof caved in and fell onto the arena. Meanwhile, the whole building listed over. You could say it was bowing to the audience, which was entertaining and diverting for the last time, pleasing it with a stunning, truly fiery spectacle. And then the walls collapsed. The efforts of the firefighters and rescuers meant half of the granary and about a quarter of the brewery were saved. A foul-smelling dawn arose. Huvenagel sat in the mud and ash in his soot-covered nightcap and caracul coat. He sat and wept woefully, whimpering like a child. The theatre, brewery and granary he owned were insured, naturally. The problem was that the insurance company was also owned by Huvenagel. Nothing, not even a tax swindle, could have made good even a fraction of the losses.
Where to now?
Asked Geralt, looking at the column of smoke, a smudged streak discolouring the sky glowing pink in the dawn.
Who do you still have to pay back, Ciri?
She glanced at him, and he immediately regretted his question. He suddenly desired to hug her, dreamed of embracing her, cuddling her, stroking her hair, protecting her, never allowing her to be alone again, to encounter evil, to encounter anything that would make her desire revenge. Yennefer remained silent. Yennefer had spent a lot of time silent lately.
No, Ciri said calmly. We're going to ride to a settlement called Unicorn. The name comes from a straw unicorn. The poor
ridiculous, miserable effigy that looks after the village. I want the residents to have, as a souvenir of what happened, a... well, if not a more valuable, then at least a more tasteful totem. I'm counting on your help, Yennefer. For without magic, I know, Ciri. And after that? The swamps of Periplut. I hope I can find my way. To a cottage amidst the swamps. We'll find the remains of a man in a cottage. I want those remains to be buried in a decent grave. Geralt still said nothing, and didn't lower his gaze. After that, Ciri continued, holding his stare without the slightest difficulty. We'll stop by the settlement of Dundara. The inn there was probably burnt down, and the innkeeper may have been murdered. Because of me. Hatred and vengeance blinded me. I shall try somehow to make it up to his family.
There's no way of doing that, he said, still looking.
I know,
she replied at once, hard, almost angrily.
But I shall stand before them in humility. I shall remember the expression in their eyes. I hope the memory of those eyes will stop me making a similar mistake. Do you understand that, Geralt?
He understands, Ciri, said Yennefer.
Both of us, believe us, understand you very well, daughter. Let's go.
The horses bore them like the wind, like a magical gale. Alarmed by the three riders flashing by, a traveller on the road raised his head. A merchant on a cart with his wares, a villain fleeing from the law, and a wandering settler driven by politicians from the land he had settled, having believed other politicians, all raised their heads. A vagabond, a deserter, and a pilgrim with a staff raised their heads. They raised their heads, amazed, alarmed, uncertain of what they had seen. Tales began to circulate around Ebbing and Jesu, about the wild hunt, about the three spectral riders. Stories were made up and spun in the evenings, in rooms smelling of melting lard and fried onions, village halls, smoky taverns, roadhouses, crofts, tar kilns, forest homesteads and border watchtowers. Tales were spun and told. About war, about heroism and chivalry, about friendship and hatred, about wickedness and betrayal, about faithful and genuine love, about the love that always triumphs, about the crimes and punishments that always befall criminals, about justice that is always just, about truth, which always rises to the surface like oil. Tales were told. People rejoiced in them, enjoyed the fairy tale fictions, because, indeed, all around in real life, things happened entirely back to front. The legend grew. The listeners, in a veritable trance, drank in the carefully measured words of the storyteller telling of the Witcher and the Sorceress, of the Tower of the Swallow, of Ciri, the Witcher girl with the scar on her face, of Kelpie, the enchanted black mare, of the Lady of the Lake. That came later, years later, many, many years later. But right now, like a seed swollen after warm rain, the legend was sprouting and growing inside people. May came suddenly, first at night, which flared up and sparkled with the distant fires of Viltana. When Ciri, strangely excited, leapt onto Kelpie and galloped towards the campfires, Geralt and Yennefer took advantage of the opportunity for a moment of intimacy. Undressing only as much as was absolutely necessary, they made love on a sheepskin coat flung onto the ground. They made love hurriedly and with abandon, in silence, without a word. They made love quickly and haphazardly, just to have more of it. And when they had both calmed down, trembling and kissing away each other's tears, they were greatly surprised how much happiness such hurried lovemaking had brought them.
Geralt?
Yes, Yen?
When we weren't together, did you go with any other women?
No.
Not once.
Not once.
Your voice didn't even waver. So I don't know why I don't believe you.
I only ever thought about you, Yen.
Now I believe you.
May came unexpectedly during the daytime too. Dandelions spattered and dotted the meadows yellow, and the trees in the orchards became fluffy and heavy with blossom. The oak woods, too distinguished to hurry, remained dark and bare, but were already being covered in a green haze, and at the edges grew bright with green splashes of birch. One night, when they were camping in a valley covered in willows, the Witcher was woken by a dream. A nightmare where he was paralyzed and defenseless, and a huge grey owl raked his face with its talons and searched for his eyes with its curved beak. He awoke, and wasn't sure if he hadn't been transported from one nightmare into another. There was a brightness billowing over their camp that the snorting horses took fright at. There was something inside the brightness, something like a dark interior, something shaped like a castle hall with a black colonnade. Geralt could see a large table, around which sat 10 shapes, 10 women. He could hear words, snatches of words.
"Bring her to us, Yennefer. We order you." "You may not order me. You may not order her. You have no power over her." "I'm not afraid of them, Mama. They can't do anything to me. If they want, I'll stand before them." "Is meeting in the 1st of June at the new moon. We order you both to appear. We warn you that we shall punish disobedience."
"I shall come right away, Philippa. Let her stay with him a little longer. Let him not be alone. Just a few days. I shall come immediately as a hostage of goodwill. Comply with my request, Philippa. Please."
The brightness pulsated. The horses snorted wildly, banging their hooves. The Witcher awoke. This time for real. The following day, Yennefer confirmed his fears after a long conversation conducted with Ciri in private.
"I'm going away," she said dryly, without any preliminaries. "I must. Ciri's staying with you, for some time at least. Then I'll summon her, and she'll also go away, and then we'll all meet again."
He nodded, reluctantly. He'd had enough of silent assent, of agreeing to everything she communicated to him, with everything she decided. But he nodded. He loved her when all was said and done.
"It's an imperative that cannot be opposed," she said more gently. "Neither can it be postponed. It simply has to be taken care of. I'm doing it for you in any case, for your good, and especially for Ciri's good."
He nodded.
"When we meet again," she said even more gently, "I'll make up for everything, Geralt. The silence, too. There's been too much silence. Too much silence between us. And now, instead of nodding, hug me and kiss me."
He did as he was asked. He loved her when all was said and done.
"Where to now?"
Ciri asked dryly, a short while after Yennefer had vanished in the flash of the oval teleporter.
"The river."
Geralt cleared his throat, fighting the pain behind his breastbone that was taking his breath away.
"The river we're riding up is the Sans Retour. It leads to a country, I must show you, for it's a fairy tale country."
Ciri turned gloomy. He saw her clench her fists.
"Every fairy tale ends badly," she drawled, "and there aren't any fairy tale lands."
"Yes, there are. You'll see."
It was the day after the full moon when they saw Toussaint bathed in greenery and sunshine, when they saw the hills, the slopes and the vineyards, the roofs of the castle's towers glistening after a morning shower. The view didn't disappoint. It was stunning. It always was.
"How beautiful it is," said Ciri enraptured. "Oh my, those castles are like children's toys, like icing decorations on a birthday cake. It makes me want to lick them."
"Architecture by Pharamond himself," Geralt informed her knowledgeably. "Wait till you see the palace and grounds of Beauclair close up."
"Palace? We're going to a palace? Do you know the king here?"
"Duchess."
"Does the Duchess?"
she asked sourly, observing him intently under her fringe.
Have green eyes, perhaps? And short black hair?
No. He cut her off, looking away. She looked completely different. I don't know where you got that from.
Leave it, Geralt, will you? What is it about this Duchess, then?
As I said, I know her. A little. Not too well, and not too close, if you want to know. But I do know the Duchess's consort, or rather a candidate for the Duchess's consort. You do too, Ciri. Ciri jabbed Kelpie with a spur, making her dance around the highway.
Don't torment me any longer.
Dandelion.
Dandelion? And the Duchess? How come?
It's a long story. We left him here at the side of his beloved. We promised to visit him returning after...
He fell silent and turned gloomy. You can't do anything about it, Ciri said softly. Don't torment yourself, Geralt. It's not your fault.
Yes, it is, he thought. It's mine. Dandelion's going to ask, and I'll have to answer. Milva, Cair, Regis, Angoulem. A sword is a double-edged weapon. Oh, by the gods, I've had enough of this. Enough. Time I was done with this. Let's go, Ciri.
In these clothes? She croaked. To a palace?
I don't see anything wrong with our clothes. He cut her off. We aren't going there to present our credentials, or to a ball. We can even meet Dandelion in the stables. Anyhow, he added, seeing her looking sulky. I'm going to the bank in the town first. I'll take a little cash out, and there are countless tailors and milliners in the cloth halls in the town square. You can buy what you want and dress as you wish.
Have you got so much cash?
She tilted her head mischievously. You can buy what you want, he repeated. Even ermine and basilisk leather slippers. I know a shoemaker who ought to have some of it left in stock.
How did you make so much money?
By killing. Let's ride, Ciri, and not waste time.
Geralt made a transfer and prepared a letter of credit, received a cheque and some cash in the branch of the Canfinelli's bank. He wrote some letters that were to be taken by the express courier service heading over the Yeruga. He politely excused himself from the luncheon the attentive and hospitable banker wanted to entertain him with. Ciri was waiting in the street, watching the horses. The street, empty a moment earlier, now teemed with people.
We must have happened on some feast or other.
Ciri gestured with her head towards a crowd heading for the town square. A fair, perhaps?
Geralt looked keenly ahead. It's not a fair.
Ah. She also looked, standing up in the stirrups. It's not another
execution, he confirmed. The most popular amusement since the war. What have we seen so far, Ciri?
Desertion, treason, cowardice in the face of the enemy, she quickly recited. And financial cases.
For supplying mouldy hardtack to the army.
The Witcher nodded. The life of an enterprising merchant is tough in wartime. They aren't going to execute a tradesman here. Ciri reined back Kelpie, who was already submerged in the crowd as though in a rippling field of corn. Just look. The scaffold's covered in a cloth, and the executioner has a fresh new hood on. They'll be executing somebody important, at least a baron. So it probably is cowardice in the face of the enemy.
Toussaint didn't have an army in the face of any foe.
Geralt shook his head.
No, Ciri. I think it's economics again. They're executing somebody for swindles in the trade of their famous wine, the basis of the economy here. Let's ride on, Ciri. We won't watch.
Ride on? How exactly?
Indeed, riding on was impossible.
In no time at all, they had become stuck in the crowd gathered in the square and were mired in the throng. There was no chance of their getting to the other side of the square. Geralt swore foully and looked back. Unfortunately, retreat was also impossible, for the wave of people pouring into the square totally clogged up the street behind them. For a moment, the crowd carried them like a river, but the movement stopped when the common folk came up against the serried wall of halberdiers surrounding the scaffold.
They're coming!
Somebody shouted, and the crowd buzzed, swayed, and took up the cry.
They're coming!
The clatter of hooves and the rattle of a wagon faded and was lost amidst the throng's bee-like humming. So they were astonished when a rack wagon pulled by two horses trundled out of a side street, and on it, having difficulty keeping his balance, stood...
Dandelion,
groaned Ciri. Geralt suddenly felt...